we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Welcome to Hard Facts with me, John White, the show that gets to the heart of the matter. Well, during his campaign for the White House, one of the most interesting aspects of Donald Trump's rhetoric was his views on NATO. For the first time since NATO was established in 1949, a candidate for the White House, Donald Trump, now President-elect Trump, questioned NATO's role in the world, whether it was still relevant, and whether it was in America's interest to continue to fund and support NATO, or whether it was inimical to America's interests. So on today's show, we're going to be asking, what is NATO? What is its role in the world? Is it, as its supporters claim, a military alliance whose function is to protect human rights and democracy around the world? Or is it, as its detractors, me being one of them, is it a military alliance concerned with the projection of imperial power? In this show, I'm joined by Dr. James Coram, who is a retired colonel in the US Army Reserve. He is a military historian, author, and an expert on counterinsurgency, who has lectured at military colleges in Estonia, across the US, and at Oxford University here in the UK. James, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure.
Now, James, I'd like to start this discussion by reading to you a paragraph that comes directly from NATO's own website, which provides a statement of purpose and what it stands for. And it reads, and I quote, "NATO is an active and leading contributor to peace and security on the international stage. It promotes democratic values and is committed to the peaceful resolution of disputes. However, if diplomatic efforts fail, it has the military capacity needed to undertake crisis management operations alone or in cooperation with other countries and international organisations." Now, James, I can only surmise that the person who typed those words must have been drunk at the time. How else to explain the yawning disjunction between the assertions made in that statement and the reality of Libya, which in 2011 was subjected to NATO's air campaign under UN Security Council Resolution 1973 to protect civilians, and which only succeeded in pushing that country into an abyss of complete economic and societal collapse, wherein terrorism and factional violence is the norm. How else to explain NATO's role in Afghanistan between 2003 and 2014 under the auspices of ISAF?
Afghanistan was a straightforward case of a NATO nation being attacked, and for the first time, Article 5 collective security was invoked. The NATO nations, from the beginning, supported and worked with the United States as the lead nation to fight the Taliban and to topple the Taliban regime, which had, by supporting quite openly Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, had committed an act of international war. This was recognized. So NATO actually did a very useful job, an important job in Afghanistan, and not only NATO, but many other EU nations took part in the military operations alongside NATO. Now, Afghanistan is one case that was an official NATO operation.
Define success for me in Afghanistan, James, considering that Afghanistan in 2015 was adjudged by Transparency International to be the 166th most corrupt country in the world out of 168, and from where 90% of the world's heroin currently emanates. So define that success. How is that in any way successful, James?
If you go back and check my words, it was a success to topple the Taliban regime and to enable a new regime. Afghanistan is in a case of ongoing civil war. Hopefully, over time, it will stabilize. The Karzai regime was extremely ineffective. Corruption is endemic in Afghanistan as in other places, and you can't ignore this. The United States had to go to war to topple the Taliban regime. What happened, and I would say a huge American failure and a failure of our European allies and other nations, was that after 2001, the Taliban regime is gone, and they ignored Afghanistan, allowed the Taliban to rebuild. There were a huge number of strategic errors made in Afghanistan, and I've written about these things, and I have called about the bad strategies. It was not bad to take out the Taliban regime. What was the mistake was over a period from about 2001 to 2006 is that we did very little to organize or help the Afghanis. And what happens is they recreated a really awful government. But I, in fact, have been doing a recent study. I'm incredibly critical of Karzai. Was in many cases for his own country and for our interests was a disaster and generally interest for the civilized world. So I'm certainly not going to defend Afghanistan, and it's still going to remain a problem. The United States remains there. A number of European nations like Britain remain in Afghanistan because the alternative is an ultra-radical Islamic regime. But, you know, certainly Afghanistan has been a dysfunctional state for decades.
Well, we say decades, James. Give us a provenance of the Taliban emanating out of the Mujahideen, who were actively supported by the Americans with regard to Russia's intervention in the country. And just to be clear, Afghanistan at the time of Russia's intervention was a progressive state wherein women had full rights. Most of the university graduates were women. Most of the country's doctors were women. It had social indicators, some of which were comparable to first world countries. And then after the Mujahideen had their way, backed by the Americans, which began, by the way, under the Carter administration, before the Russians went into the country at the behest of the legitimate government at the time. Years later, we now have a failed state. So when you talk about Islamic extremism, we have to understand that the US has used Islamic extremism as a proxy when it suited its interest. And what we're facing now is blowback. Don't you think, James?
Well, no, I mean, the Mujahideen had been fighting the Soviet-supported Afghanistan government in the 70s. And in fact, one of the reasons the Soviets intervened in Afghanistan to depose the Afghani government and replace it with another one was they thought the next one might be a better one to fight the Mujahideen. So the Mujahideen were not created by the Americans. They go way back. This is basic. Now, the Americans did support the Mujahideen, as did the Saudi Arabians, all kinds of different groups. After the Soviets left Afghanistan, the regime collapsed in 1991. Afghanistan went into a period of 3 years of civil war in which one faction of the Mujahideen, which was the Taliban, seized power over most of the country and imposed a genuine, vicious and brutal dictatorship. We're talking mass murder of prisoners, we're talking mass abuse and so forth.
James, let me push on now to Russia and the grievances which Moscow has with NATO and their basis in the negotiations that led to the formal ending of the Soviet Union between 1989 and 1991. Now, Russia maintains and has maintained from the outset that they were given verbal assurances from US Secretary of State James Baker, who was the US Secretary of State in the first Bush administration at that time, along with German Chancellor Helmut Kohl at that time, and also the German Foreign Minister at that time, Hans Dencker, that there would be no NATO expansion eastwards in return for Russia acquiescing to the reunification of Germany and that German state then becoming a NATO member. And this story was covered in a Der Spiegel article which appeared in November of 2009. And I'd like to read to you a passage from this article.
Well, I'm familiar with Der Spiegel. I'm completely fluent in German, and I followed Der Spiegel for many years and so forth. I want you to know this whole issue about Baker's papers have been looked at. There is no, from his notes taken at the time, there's no indication that there was an agreement of that nature. And secondly, part of the entire deal was for negotiating the Soviet army out of Eastern Europe between 1991-1994 was that The NATO nations paid the Soviet Union many billions of dollars to relocate their armed forces back in the Soviet Union. And there were formal treaties drawn up and official internationally binding agreements. And the Soviet Union and Russia, after 91, took the money and they accepted those agreements. And those agreements did not say anything about limit NATO's expansion. So, you know, where I come from, if you sign a deal and you accept a lot of money to do something, and then you go back and say, oh, no, that's not the deal.
I hardly think James Der Spiegel, with all due respect, is the in-house magazine of the Kremlin. But can I just read this passage from Der Spiegel, just so that we can get some context to this exchange? And the passage from the article, which is relevant to this discussion, reads as follows. After speaking with many of those involved and examining previously classified British and German documents in detail, Spiegel has concluded that there was no doubt that the West did everything it could to give the Soviets the impression that NATO membership was out of the question for countries like Poland, Hungary or Czechoslovakia. On February 10th, 1990, between 4 and 6:30 p.m., Genscher, the West German foreign minister I mentioned earlier, Genscher spoke with Shevardnadze, who was then the Soviet foreign minister. According to the German record of the conversation, which was only recently declassified, Genscher said, and I quote, "We are aware that NATO membership for a unified Germany raises complicated questions. For us, however, one thing is certain, NATO will not expand to the east." And because the conversation revolved mainly around East Germany, Genscher added explicitly, "As far as the non-expansion of NATO is concerned, this also applies in general." Now, since that time, 11 former Eastern Bloc countries are now NATO members. Surely Vladimir Putin has a point, does he not? This is a direct threat to Russia's security.
A verbal discussion with a foreign minister is not an international agreement. You know, whatever Genscher said did not bind all of NATO or the Western democratic nations to a formal agreement. You know, Obama, for example, we're having a discussion in America right now. Obama has made an agreement, a presidential agreement with Iran. The day that Obama leaves office, the next American president can tear that up. It's absolutely, even though it's a supposedly a signed agreement, that's a presidential agreement. In the United States system, the only things that can't be torn up are treaties. And treaties have to be accepted by two-thirds of the Senate. So all of these discussions and so forth about politicians who are long gone, that's really interesting. You know, there were verbal assurances given at Yalta, too. Okay, but we're talking about international law, international agreements, and NATO very quickly expanded, which was interesting.
James, an international agreement, we're not talking about buying and selling a car. We're talking about issues of global security.
Yes.
And what use is an international agreement if the world is on fire? Join us after the break where we'll be continuing the discussion. Hard facts. Well, welcome back to the second half of the show where I'm discussing NATO with James Corum. And before we get back to the discussion, we hit the streets and we asked the public what they thought. We asked, do you think Russia is a threat to NATO or is NATO a threat to Russia? Let's have a listen.
Military aggression, expansionism, impinging upon the Russian sphere of influence.
We shouldn't be building anti-defence missiles and all the rest of it near Russian borders, the Ukraine and all the rest of it. Otherwise, it's an act of war. If we'd done it to the US, then if Russian built anti-missile, whatever the heck they're building, anti-air missiles in Cuba, then the Americans will take that as an act of war, and the Russians should do the same.
Well, they're a threat to each other as much as one is to the other.
Just because of everything that's been in the media, really. I don't know if it's the true story or not, but it does portray Russia as a threat.
Well, as we hear, the public really understands NATO more than I think its supporters would like, especially the first gentleman who spoke. I think he should actually be presenting a show on Sputnik, given his understanding of NATO as an organisation concerned with, in his words, military aggression and expansionism. He's now asked you this, to consider this hypothesis. Imagine if the BRIC countries of Brazil, Russia, India and China were to elevate their association or their relationship to forge a military alliance, such as we see with NATO. And imagine that they managed to enlist the support of a Mexican government and with a strong anti-American sentiment in the country. And imagine they were to undertake military exercises in Mexico that were a clear threat to America's security. And imagine they were to install and make operational a missile defence shield, say, I don't know, Cuba, 1962. What do you think Washington's response to such a state of affairs would be, James?
Well, you know, this is such a hypothetical that it wanders into the absurdity. For one thing, Mexico is almost...
It's a hypothetical, James.
...closely bound to the United States by NAFTA.
And soon to be a wall if Donald Trump gets his way.
Would be if they cut away from U.S. economic trade, as, you know, Canada and Mexico are America's biggest trade partners, would be national...
James, I'm sorry. No, I'm asking you to deal with the hypothetical as I put it. I'm not asking you.
Okay.
We understand the situation.
How
would Washington react to that threat to their security? How would Washington react to hostile troops on its border? And let's not forget, James, this is what we seem to forget. Russia knows what invasion looks like. The scars of the Second World War continue.
I have lived in countries that were invaded and taken over by the USSR in 1940. I lived in Estonia 5.5 years. I have friends that went to the gulag. And do you want to know why NATO existed? NATO existed because of the aggressive threat that Russia tends to pose against its neighbours.
Well, I have to remind you, James, that without that Russian aggression, that Nazi Germany would have taken over the entire Europe, and the atrocities that we saw vis-a-vis the Holocaust would have been 10 times greater. So kindly credit the Soviet Union.
The Soviet Union were Hitler's allies from 1939 to 1941. They signed the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Russia and Germany were closely linked for 2 years until the Germans double-crossed Stalin.
But that was because
the reason of Germany's early success was USSR's support.
Calm down, James.
Why the Nazis had initial success. They had all those resources from Russia.
James, I'd be happy to go into a history of the Second World War, but just on the Hitler-Stalin Pact, that was in relation to the Treaty of Munich in 1938, during which the Allied powers at the time gave Hitler Czechoslovakia. When Russia tried to enact a collective security agreement with France to protect Czechoslovakian sovereignty, it was refused by France, and Poland refused to allow the transshipment of 1 million Russian troops to go through Poland to defend Czechoslovakia. Then before that, we had the Soviet Union, which was the only country to stand up against fascism in the context of the Spanish Civil War. So I think Russia was entitled at the time to worry that there was going to be an invasion of its country. It didn't know at that time from where or for which constellation of state. So we have to be very, very careful.
We're going in ancient history here. But the thing is that when NATO was founded, there was a clear and open threat from the very vast army of Joseph Stalin. And NATO was a brilliant idea.
Was the Soviet Union was a country under threat by the U.S. presence in Western Europe? What do you think?
There was one division, American division, in Western Europe in 1948. We had no forces. The West Germans had no army. West Germany, and I wrote a book about this called Rearming Germany, Brill Press. It's an excellent book. Now, what you ought to look at is that after NATO was founded, it was only with the Korean War, the open invasion.
James, can we come back to NATO? Because we're short of time. And we really need your expertise on NATO, if you don't mind.
I've served in NATO.
I'd like to bring things forward to the Ukraine crisis at the beginning of 2014, when the last legitimate democratically elected government of Ukraine, headed by Viktor Yanukovych, was toppled on the back of a Western-backed coup and push by a mob.
James, excuse me for speaking whilst
you're interrupting.
I've been struggling for many years now to try to overthrow this incredibly...
Are you questioning the legality of the Yanukovych government in Ukraine at the start of 2014 as per the Ukrainian constitution? This was the last... This was a legitimately elected government.
It was a dirty and, frankly, not very legitimate
government. Whether it's dirty or not, James, it was constitutionally elected, and it should only have been replaced by an election, another elected government. So that government was forced from power in 2014 when you had the likes of neocon Victoria Nuland of the US State Department arriving in Maidan Square, giving the protesters biscuits and encouraging them to continue with their protest. Protesters which, by the way, were driven by ugly, reactionary, anti-Russian nationalist forces and avowed neo-fascists of right sector.
Stop using these terms like reactionary and so forth.
Ukraine has been
a pseudo-authoritarian state and had been from the 1990s into our century. And, you know, it's a tragic case because, unlike the Baltic states or Poland, they couldn't make the break with the old authoritarian system, which is why they're impoverished and broken today as a country.
James, I think they're impoverished because of the events of 2014. But James, we really have a problem because obviously you're looking at these events through the prism of Western ideology, wherein the US, Washington writ, should be able to run wherever it likes, whenever it likes. And we're talking about NATO being used as a tool of imperial...
I'm a person who's written books highly critical of the last two administrations. And as an American, I'm free to do that.
Yes.
So, you know, as far as trying to, you know, link me with Western ideology, in the Western ideology, I am free to criticize my government. When I worked for the U.S. Defense Department, I would write articles critical of their strategic approach. And in a free country, you can do that. Ukraine was not a free country. They arrested opposition and so forth. The country basically finally collapsed as the Soviet Union did. It had little legitimacy. It was a genuinely popular revolution. It wasn't
a wonderful, happy country.
What's
James, that's delusional.
Really?
People in eastern Ukraine, the country is in bits. Inflation is at over 40% as a direct consequence of Western intervention
Ukraine
and pave the way for it to joining NATO. So you're talking people like such as John McCain, who belongs to the Yeehaw school of US foreign policy, a man whose quest for another Vietnam War never ends. These people were arriving in Maidan Square. Imagine if Russian politicians were to arrive in Mexico to cheer on anti-American. I go back to this hypothetical. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Russia has legitimate security and strategic interests across its own borders. And we have the absurdity, James.
An agreement in 1993, international agreement was signed guaranteeing the borders of the Ukraine, and Russia ripped that up, invaded the
Crimea. Well, the West certainly never guaranteed the borders of Ukraine. But let's move on to the Warsaw summit we just had, James, in July, the Warsaw NATO summit. And we have the absurd situation where at a time when Russian servicemen are shedding blood in the struggle against ISIS in Syria, that we have thousands of NATO troops exercising close to Russia's borders. That has to be absurd, isn't it?
No, Russia is in Syria for its own agenda and its own means.
What agenda is that, James?
We're talking fighting a parallel war. Russia's interests are aligned with Assad. Frankly, I don't think that our Western leaders have a clue what they're doing in Syria. They keep trying to find these Syrian moderates, and I think that's silly.
But James, that strategic incompetence defines NATO. That's in NATO's DNA, because it's trying to uphold unipolar world, which is untenable and cannot be maintained given the emergence of Russia and China and other emerging economies. See, we can't have a world in which international law is a pick and mix, in which national sovereignty is a gift of Washington to be bestowed and taken away at its behest. You know, national sovereignty is enshrined in the UN Charter of 1945, and since the demise of the Soviet Union, it has been shredded, as has international law. And that is a fundamental problem with the world today, and that's why we're closer now to direct military confrontation between East and West than we ever have been since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. In no way can this be considered a success for NATO.
Well, you know, it would help if Russia didn't, you know, keep invading countries like Georgia and Ukraine.
James, you must be having a laugh.
Invasions,
James, you must be having a laugh. Invading
Although Georgia 2008 was not
Mikhail
invasion.
Mikhail Saakashvili, the then president of Georgia, was an avowed proponent of Ronald Reagan. He tried to lead the West into direct conflict with Russia. This was averred by none other than Hillary Clinton later on, who said that we were misled by Saakashvili. Russia was there to aid South Ossetians who were having their rights undermined by Georgia.
Oh, but I know all about South Ossetia. I've even met some of the ludicrous figures who act as the puppet regime of this, the only country in the world that recognizes the Republic of South Ossetia is Russia. This is a joke regime.
Well, it's very disappointing to hear you discuss the citizens of South Ossetia.
I will certainly characterize their government as being an absurd Russian puppet
government. Any more absurd than Kosovo?
Come on.
Any more absurd than the Kosovan government, James?
I have not been a great fan of the NATO operations in Kosovo. NATO, in many respects, in 1999... carried out, first of all, I could say from an operational viewpoint, there was no effective planning. There were a huge number of mistakes made by NATO. I would certainly put a lot of blame onto Madeleine Albright. We used to nickname her, those of us who worked in the Defense Department, Madeleine Halfbright. You see, as American perfidy around the world, in many cases, is really blundering.
Can I ask you what your views are of Donald Trump, who has not been as supportive of NATO as every other candidate for that office has over the last 4 or 5 decades?
No, he's been critical of NATO.
Yeah. So this gives us an interesting potential, because don't you foresee the situation where Russia and NATO could actually be allies in trying to reassert stability in the world and in the struggle against terrorism? After all, both citizens of all countries are under threat from this menace, which is an equal opportunities menace. So don't you think Vladimir Putin's continued calls for an alliance with the West vis-a-vis ISIS and various other al-Qaeda affiliates, don't you think that should be adhered to and listened to? And don't you think Donald Trump is listening to that call?
Well, first of all, Russia and the West have been allied in one issue, and that is fighting the radicals in Afghanistan, because most of the NATO supply, as you well know, flows through Russia, because those are the rail links. And the best way to supply forces, large amounts of fuel and so forth, must flow through Russia to get to Afghanistan. Russia has been cooperative in NATO logistics, and NATO recognizes this, which is one reason why NATO is very careful in dealing with Russia, because of the Afghanistan conflict. So the Russia and NATO do cooperate against radical Islamic issues. They certainly don't cooperate in Georgia. They don't cooperate in Ukraine. NATO is not eager, I can guarantee you, NATO is not eager to bring the Ukraine into NATO. Ukraine is not a highly functional state.
We're running out of time, I'm afraid. It's been fantastic to have your participation in this show. Can
sure.
I just summarise what my view of NATO is? And I think the view of many people who oppose NATO. NATO has nothing to do with democracy, and democracy has nothing to do with NATO. It is about power, which in the 21st century translates to the maintenance of a unipolar world in which Washington's writ runs wherever it decides it should, regardless of international law or national sovereignty. Now, at the start of this show, I read out a paragraph of NATO's mission and what it stands for. But I have another paragraph which I think gets to the heart of the matter, which after all is what this show is all about. And this came from George Kennan, who was a US State Department Mandarin credited with devising the policy of containment vis-a-vis the Soviet Union at the start of the Cold War in the late 1940s. And Kennan writes in the form of a classified internal memo, "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratisation. I put it to you that this is the real function of NATO, to continue that disparity in wealth and power across the world. And I put it to you that it's been an unmitigated disaster, especially for people across the global south. And I put it to you, finally, that the sooner NATO joins a scrap heap of history, the better." James Corum, thank you for your participation. You've been listening to John White. Until next time, I leave you with the words of Malcolm X: if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Thank you.